frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on January 14th, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate and Rachel joined me to talk about the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency and Border Patrol, as well as expanded federal surveillance. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again in studio this week is Nate. Hey, Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
And joining us again, as always, on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Happy to be here again.
Let's start off by talking about immigration and some of the agencies involved with that. There's been a lot of news lately in the past several weeks regarding that in the United States. I guess let's start out with the TPS stuff, temporary protected status, because Donald Trump really does not like a lot of the countries involved with that and has made a long time habit with increasing frequency now as president of making derogatory comments about people from those countries. Temporary protected status is basically a sort of thing where instead of being at risk for deportation, you could file to get, say, oh, I can't go back to my country because of something like an earthquake. And then they would give you this sort of, it's temporary, but in many cases was like 15 or almost 20 years or even longer in some cases. There's a lot of countries that have TPS status. That's being rolled back for some of them. Nate, you wanted to talk about some of the countries that got the TPS status got revoked by Trump.
Yeah, so El Salvador, I think, was one that was prominently referenced, also Haiti, and sort of the infamous comments Trump was making were in a meeting referencing a lot of these immigration deals and things he was making with the Democrats. But I think it was also Sudan was also included in there. He caused quite a firestorm, but maybe less focus was on the actual impact that some of these policies would have if they actually end.
Yeah, some TPS. People got real hung up on the exact wordings that he used as opposed to the implications of it or why we have these programs or what the U.S. relationship to some of these countries is. El Salvador and Haiti in particular, I think, coming in for a lot of scrutiny because of the fact that the U.S. has, let's say, a close and challenging relationship with those countries.
Yeah, Trump terminated TPS for El Salvador, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Sudan. So those are the four countries. But there's 10 more nations, or there are 10 nations in the program when he took office a year ago. So there's potentially more TPS to for him to eliminate in the future.
Now, a lot of folks were coming to Haiti because of various destructive U.S. policies that affected Haiti. They're coming from Haiti to the United States and then officially getting to stay because of the earthquake. Similarly, there had been an earthquake back in like 2001, I think, in El Salvador. That was when the TPS status was imposed there. But a lot of people previously had come to the United States to flee the violence perpetrated or instigated by the United States in El Salvador. That doesn't seem to be getting that much attention. Haiti is, in particular, is one of the countries that the United States has intervened in militarily and economically more than almost any other country in the world. This is something going way back into the early 19th century where the United States was just immensely stressed out by the possibility of a rich, black, independent, non-slaveholding country on its doorstep.
Yeah, and that's not to mention all the different times, and especially in Latin America during the early 20th century, where there were like U.S. invasions, all sorts of gunboat diplomacy and things like that, and like Marines were occupying various Central American countries for years at a time sometimes, and then of course all of the regime overthrows in the 20th century, so there's a long history there.
Rachel, did you have any comments you wanted to make about the TPS news?
I think it's good to highlight that 97% of Salvadorans that do have this protected status are employed and paying taxes, and more than half own their own homes. So they've invested a lot of capital and they provide a lot to the economy, and immigration has always made us great. And this group is no exception to that. They are putting a lot of money into the economy. They've become pillars of their communities, and to just rip them away from this country that they call home now, it seems especially cruel.
Right. I think we should be careful there and make the distinction. We're talking about the fact that they're integrated closely into our communities and are a vital part of the United States. Not to say like, oh, if they weren't valued members of society, or they weren't contributing anything, or they weren't part of the economy, that they would be somehow lesser or not worthy of this protection. Like, that's not what we're saying. Because everybody that's here is part of our society, and like, you know, a lot of people deserve protection for many things and many reasons. And even if you're not like, you know, some sort of rock star student or, you know, pillar of your local community or whatever, then you still deserve protection, and you still deserve to not be torn out of your community and sent back to this country that you maybe have been away from for a very long time. And in many cases, like the situation in El Salvador specifically, as with some of the stuff in Haiti, but like El Salvador in particular, the U.S. policies under the previous two administrations of like sending back a lot of dangerous cartel members, extraditing them back to or deporting them back to El Salvador from the United States, that's a small country, and that really destabilized the populations there. And that's why we had a lot of those like unaccompanied minors coming to the United States, that sort of thing. It's like people were just absolutely desperate to get out of there, and we're sending people back after things have gotten even worse and just putting them back into these really dangerous situations. So there's like a political asylum argument to be made as well.
Well,
right. And also, there's been 192,000 children who have been born in the U.S. of Salvadoran parents. So the human impact of ripping these parents out of their country, out of their adopted country, back to their home country, and all these children that have never lived in El Salvador and would not have a home there and have no lives there. So it would be very devastating for them to go, to be sent to this country that they just have no connection to.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think it's also worth remembering how Hillary during the campaign was talking about how we need to send him back to send a message. And I think she was specifically referring to Salvadorian, other Central American unaccompanied minors and refugees that have been coming home. And I'm looking in this article that you're quoting from, Rachel, and some people are talking about how for people it's worse in El Salvador than it was during the civil wars in the 80s and 90s. And there's just all sorts of, you know, criminal gangs kidnapping children and things like that. And so it definitely seems like we're sending people back into this sort of chaos if, you know, this has ended. So.
And Trump obviously having a very negative opinion of these countries, although, you know, Nate and I were talking about this before the show. You know, on the one hand, he's making all these racist comments about various countries, but on the other hand, is his view of some of these countries that dissimilar from sort of the general American view of these countries? You know, is that a broader indictment of us? You know, somebody yesterday referred to Trump as the most us that we have ever had a president, like that he is really kind of the most American president we've had, in the sense of just openly like stripping away the, you know, higher aspirations and just being like, nope, this is me. Like, I'm not just crass, but I'm racist and have these white supremacy positions and, you know, promote everything from this extractive lens. Like, it's just kind of ripping away the veneer and just taking this open attitude or whatever. And a lot of this stuff obviously like way predates when he was president, like his views on Haitians, which I feel like did not generate as much of a stir as him using a naughty word to describe some of these countries, in, you know, and compare them negatively to Norway or whatever. Like that got a lot more attention than him saying that he thought that everyone in Haiti had AIDS.
Yeah. So 3 weeks ago, New York Times reported that President Trump had said something hugely offensive about Haitians, that they all, quote, all have AIDS in a June meeting about immigration. I'm just quoting from the Washington Post here. The White House strenuously denied it. And the fact that the story landed on December 23rd helped it escape scandal proportions. And basically, they're coming around and saying this lends credence to that. And when I heard that quote floated out, I was like, yeah, that seems like something he would say. I mean, that's not surprising in the at all the slightest.
Well, so. And that goes back to, like, I mean, in many ways, I think other people have noted this, that Donald Trump is kind of frozen as himself from the 1980s in, like, the tabloids and everything. Like, and maybe even is regressing back toward that with some of his dementia issues. President Trump, like, just, I mean, he's this dude from, like, the New York rich people scene. And one of the things from the racist New York rich people scene in the late 1980s was alleging that everyone in Haiti had AIDS. Like, that was a thing that was in 1989 and 1990 when you started having the first waves of a lot of these Haitians coming to the United States, in many cases undocumented, but not universally. A lot of, like, you know, these racist rich protests, you know, in New York or whatever, being like, we can't have these people coming to our country. Like, and again, I think that's probably more of an issue than just sort of making a blanket statement that all these countries are bad and using slightly stronger language than that, which is, again, not really a Trump specific thing. Like, that's a thing that everyone around him thinks. It's a thing that a lot of the American political system thinks, and not very, like, they just wouldn't say it out loud. But a lot of them think that as well. They have very negative opinions of these countries. And they're not thinking about, like, well, why is Haiti always struggling? Why is Nicaragua have various issues? Well, hey, maybe it's because of the constant U.S. military occupations every few years of Haiti or Nicaragua. You know, why are so many Haitians trying to come to the United States for better job opportunities? Well, could it have anything to do with the United States and the State Department very forcefully pushing against a minimum wage increase after the earthquake in 2010? And that was under the Obama administration. That was under Secretary Hillary Clinton at the State Department, that these people were like, no, we can't have a minimum wage increase in Haiti after this earthquake. Like, if wages were higher, if there were more opportunities, if a lot of these opportunities hadn't been squelched by United States policy, military and economic in these countries, then things would be going a lot better in those countries.
I think Fruit of the Loom was involved in that.
There were various
clothing manufacturing.
Yeah, corporations that were like, well, we will provide some jobs in Haiti, but only if these conditions are met. Rachel, your other thoughts on this?
Yeah, we have a long history of making their lives worse with our interventions, and then we kind of tend to forget and be like, why are these countries so terrible to live in, and why do people flee to America? And I think we like to poo-poo the effects without realizing our part in the causes of destabilizing these countries, stifling their economies, forcing them to make cheap goods to be exported to the U.S. So I think it takes a lot of reflection. And like you said, Trump is kind of giving voice to the id of the country and saying out loud what everyone else has previously whispered. So I think we as a nation need to reflect on the part we've played in interfering with these countries.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and sort of speaks to something I've sort of long thought about this country in comparison to, like, say, like the British Empire or something like that, where they would, like, extensively study various countries and, like, go there as, like, viceroys and things, as colonial administrators, whereas America, you know, can't really be bothered to learn anything about any of the countries that it runs around and invades or, you know, bombs or drone strikes and things like that. And, you know, at the run up to the Iraq war and things like that, we didn't have the requisite, like, Arabic translators and things like that, because it just seems like we're pretty uncurious and think we're the center of the world. And from there, oh, we don't really need to know the history and exactly the, you know, how various societies around the world are structured, because, oh, we're the best and everyone else is worse than us, so we can just disparage them and then be mean to them when they come here. So that's sort of, you know, we're not really thinking through a lot of the various implications and things like that. So,
all right. So we've talked about TPS. What other stories have we been following with regard to immigration enforcement in the United States? There were some caregiver deportation stories. There were some sanctuary city issues. The 7-Eleven raids. Nate, where do we want to go on this now?
Yeah, you mentioned a couple different things. I'm just looking at some articles. It seems like they're really stepping up deportations of just all sorts of, you know, under the Obama administration, the formulation was always, oh, we're going after the gang members and only violent offenders. And oftentimes that wasn't at all like actually what happened, or people that had like minor arrest issues and things like that were also deported. But now it seems like the Trump administration is really going after just sort of everyday normal types. And so that there's a deportation of an Ohio man who's the sole provider and trained as a medical caregiver of a six-year-old paraplegic boy. That's something I think happened in Cincinnati. Trump's ICE pick, acting director Thomas Homan said that the Justice Department needs to file charges against the sanctuary cities and hold back their funding, saying that politicians who help run them should be charged with crimes. So that's interesting. There's also, as Bill, you mentioned, there have been a lot of 7-Eleven stores who have had ICE raids conducted against them, and they're trying to do crackdown, I guess, against the actual employers. And this is something that has been an issue going back for many, many years, going back to like after the Reagan immigration bill and things like that, where basically Congress passed a bill with like some immigration issues in there, but then they promised to have sanctions against people that would hire illegal immigrants or undocumented, and they just never happened. So there's never been an actual enforcement mechanism against people that employ undocumented immigrants. But people are saying, you know, yeah, you can raid like a couple of these 7-Elevens and things like that, but people are just going to go down the street and work for someone else. And it doesn't seem like, you know, Trump, with all of his business connections, things like that, is really going to go hard after like the large like corporations that employ undocumented workers. It just sort of seems like they're going to do some raids, they're going to arrest some people. But it doesn't seem like everything's going to be changed. So, but they're trying to posture like it is. So I guess, Mark Kirkorian, director of the Center for Immigration Studies, which is pretty anti-immigrant, if I remember, said the inspections offered a, quote, good sign the administration was serious about going after their employers. But he said the administration would need to go beyond audits. It is important for Trump to show that they're not just arresting the hapless schmo from Honduras, but also the politically powerful American employer, he said. And I don't really think that's going to happen anytime soon, considering many of those politically powerful American employers are like in Trump's cabinet, things like that. So that's kind of an issue.
Think that while they're making this show of like targeting 7-Elevens and saying, oh, we're going to stand up to these corporations that are employing undocumented people, there's also the flip side, which is the corporations that are extensively cooperating with ICE, maybe even above and beyond the requirements.
Right,
In September, there was a big thing in 2017 about Motel 6, like basically if flagging for ICE potentially people that they thought were undocumented. There are a lot of people kind of like disappearing from Motel 6s in immigration raids, and they confirmed that like, oh yes, definitely some managers had taken it upon themselves to like, you know, establish relationships with local ICE and like rat out the patrons, you know, after they had paid for a hotel room and whatever, and well, we're stopping this policy. And I saw just in the last like week or so that there are people saying that they think Motel 6 is still doing this. And, you know, that maybe this goes even higher and potentially was something that was actually being authorized further up the corporate chain. I don't know if that's necessarily been confirmed, but like it is still in the news that there's this potential like kind of connection there. So some corporations seem to be sort of like pretty psyched to be working with the Immigration Customs Enforcement on this horrible deportation stuff. Rachel, did you have any reactions to any of these particular stories?
I just think these stories, such as the deportation of the paraplegic boy's caregiver, and I think earlier last year there was a story about a man who was well-respected in his community who owned a Mexican restaurant, I believe, and he was deported, and the townspeople overwhelmingly voted for Trump, but they were like, not our undocumented immigrant. Like, so I think we see undocumented immigrants as this like monolith of people who are trying to take our jobs and take government assistance and whatnot. And I think once you put a human face to these undocumented workers, you see just how well respected they are in their communities, how well they've established lives in our country. And I think it just really highlights the cruelty of ICE. These people haven't really, they're not violent criminals. I think the paraplegic boy's caregiver had just had a couple DUIs, which are bad, yes, but I don't think it's warranted that we detain him indefinitely and deport him and leave this paraplegic boy without a caregiver who has been trained. He has skills. He's the only father figure this boy knows. It just really highlights the cruelty of ICE, and I think people are kind of seeing that. And there have been calls on the left to abolish ICE. I just want to say, yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, not to cut you off there, because we're going to definitely circle back to that in more depth. But like, you know, to your point, to give the example with the DUI that you were talking about, like, yes, that's absolutely bad. But there are other punishments and sanctions that you can put in place that are proportionate to that and more in line with how we treat. I mean, we don't treat DUIs very well in general in the judicial mm-hmm. system in this country, but you know, like, this is something that came up during our sanctuary city or safe community discussions in my city in Massachusetts last year, which is basically like, some of the people were like, oh, we have to enforce this and we have to turn people over to ICE because that's enforcing the rule of law. And the counter to that we were making in favor of this sanctuary policy was like, no, the enforcing the rule of law would be applying a consistent policy. So if someone gets pulled over for a DUI or a lesser traffic violation or something, they don't get deported to like a dangerous country that where people want them dead. Like, they, you know, go to prison or something like that, you know, or they serve their time or they get their license revoked or whatever you have to do to like solve the specific problem. But like, deportation is such a nuclear option that's the one they're just going straight toward on so many of these things. Nate?
Yeah, Rachel was mentioning this article from last year, and I had read it at the time, and I recently just pulled it up, but it's quite interesting to see a lot of these sort of Trump-supporting people in very sort of rural, white, southern Illinois. County is West Frankfort, Illinois. As Terry Chambers, a barber on Main Street, put it, the president simply wants to get rid of the bad eggs. And the article goes on, and then they took Carlos, and talking about how Carlos was a manager of a Mexican restaurant in the area, city of 8,000, and, you know, he was very friendly with everyone in the community, and even hosted a law enforcement appreciation day at the restaurant last summer as police officer facing criticism, involved in the Rotary Club, cancer fundraisers, cleanup days. And it's like, yeah, even if you're hosting, like, We Love the Cops Day, they're still going to come grab you. And, you know, that's just how these things work now. Yeah. So,
and worth noting as well, you know, that John Kelly, who is now the White House chief of staff, but had started off the year in 2017 as the Department of Homeland Security guy. And before that was the military commander in the U.S. military for effectively like Latin America, basically. There was an Intercept article that came out in, I think September of 2017, or October of 2017, talking about leaked emails from back in like February of 2017, where he, like, from the highest level, Kelly himself ordering that he wanted like dossiers on like high profile criminal, you know, really dangerous criminal behavior, by these undocumented immigrants in various cities. So anytime they did a raid, they were supposed to be like, you know, we did a raid and picked up X number of, you know, dozen or so people in this, or 30 people in this city. And there were, you know, three different like heinous murders or rapes or whatever that that three of them had committed or something like that. And they were supposed to do this for every city as like a way of kind of justifying this policy to offset the fact that most of the people they were picking up were like the lowest hanging fruit possible. The people who were not really particularly hiding and were like doing police appreciation day at their taco restaurant in a town of 8,000, you know, that was the type of people that they've been picking up. And it is something actually we talked about last week a bit on the show, Nate and I did, this notion where like the arrests and detentions are up, but the deportations are down because of course they've found a way to like best of both worlds from their perspective, worst in our perspective is like, well, if we don't deport them, then we can just keep detaining them in like private federal detention facilities or contracts to county facilities. That's happened in Massachusetts and various other New England states. The guy who is now the head of ICE, Homan, was given a presidential commendation by Barack Obama in 2015 for basically shepherding out the all the undocumented, unaccompanied minors and family members during that crisis in 2014. He personally oversaw the deportations of 920,000 people, but he also spearheaded the management and reform of the largest civil detention system in the nation, according to the New York Daily News, and by adding detention beds, which shows that like that's the trend that things were heading in, was like, how can we make as much money as possible off this? But in order to do that, of course, you have to keep rounding up more and more of these people who are not the like bloodthirsty criminals that Trump is allegedly talking about. And again, this has to do with the same kind of premise with TPS and stuff, is like, well, we got to get our deportation numbers up. How do we do that? Oh, kick out all of the like Salvadorans and Haitians who aren't doing anything and aren't bothering anyone and haven't committed any crimes, but we know exactly who they are because they're on record, similar to like trying to end the DACA protections for Dreamers. It's like, you know, we have these lists of people, we can deport these people easily, and then we can go and detain these other people that are the low-hanging fruit in the community and get those people into detention. And, you know, deport the like deport right away, basically, the like really violent people, allegedly. I mean, again, as I said earlier, that's how a lot of like MS-13 people got sent back to Central America, was because they were doing actual serious crimes in the United States, and that led to their deportations. But without going around in too many circles here, you know, this does lead to the questions about the role of ICE, which Rachel was bringing up earlier. And I think, you know, we hear from and talk to a lot of people on the left, and the position of that we should abolish ICE and start over from scratch with a new sort of immigration agency or something to deal with that, is popular among people we talk to, but doesn't seem to have really filtered out to, you know, anyone else particularly. It's not really gaining any sort of currency or traction in major circles. I haven't really heard elected Democrats in Congress like talking about that or anything. John Kelly certainly not in favor of that. He's not hashtag abolish ICE. He gave this speech at one point. This is quoted in the New Yorker. If lawmakers do not like the laws they've passed and we are charged to enforce, then they should have the courage and skill to change the laws. Otherwise, they should shut up and support the men and women on the front lines. My people have been discouraged from doing their jobs for nearly a decade. He said that while he was running the Department of Homeland Security.
Well, Kelly's also the guy who's like, don't ask me a question if like you don't know a Gold Star family or something like that. So
he's an angry, very authoritarian person.
But yeah, I do think it is interesting, though, when we were talking about this shortly before the show, that it used to be INS, and INS was only abolished in 2003 and transformed into ICE. And for some reason, I thought it was still going, or maybe it just had faded out in the mid-2000s. But yeah, so change is possible in this situation.
Yeah, I mean, so Rachel and I talked about this a little bit a few days ago, and like we're kind of floating this out on Twitter. You know, people still use the term INS, even, because the thing is, that wasn't really that much. That wasn't like an abolition. That was like a post 9/11 reform where they were rolling agencies together.
Homeland Security.
And so I think everyone who was in INS basically became ICE agents stuff, you know. So that wasn't like the kind of change that we're talking about.
No,
but like we need to be thinking about sort of from the ground up. Like,
yeah, there could be a different agency that operates.
There has to be a different way of doing this. And I don't know where the future is on that. But like, the two sort of agencies that deal with this most closely, which they're both under Department of Homeland Security, but they're not part of the same agency as far as I'm aware, Immigration, Customs Enforcement, ICE, and then the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, which is commonly referred to as Border Patrol. And we're going to talk about them in the second segment a little bit more as well. But, like, you know, I mean, they're totally out of control. They're not just behaving completely out of control in a lot of these recent raids, although they are that as well. But there was that situation in the chaotic period when Trump took office, and then they issued the bans with the airports and stuff, and like the customs people are the ones who deal with that at the airport, and they were, you know, trying to put people back on return flights immediately, and then the courts issued a stay on that and said this is not probably not constitutional, but you can't put it into effect right now. And they were like openly sending letters saying, like, or issuing memos or making statements like, we only answer to Trump. And, you know, and Kelly himself, John Kelly, the new Homeland Security secretary at the time, like, said, oh, we're going to comply with this court order saying we can't do this. And he had Border Patrol people in his own department saying, no way, we only answer to the Oval Office and, you know, Steve Bannon and Trump, like, that we don't have to follow this. And there were Democratic members of Congress saying openly, we have a constitutional crisis right now where these, you know, heavily armed Customs and Border Patrol people are refusing to follow court orders and are saying they only answer directly to the President of the United States. And he is busy talking about how he's going to add thousands more Border Patrol jobs and, you know, had been endorsed by their union. I mean, that's a very precarious situation. You see this in other countries as well. Like, Tunisia is a great example where for a long time, the regime there, instead of having the army backing it, it was the police, basically, that the like the border police and stuff would have immense control and influence with the government and were very loyal to that government. And, you know, we don't like it's very disruptive and dangerous. We only hear about, oh, like Russia is corrupting our democracy or whatever. But it's like, well, what about these tons and tons of Border Patrol and ICE guys who are saying, I only answer to President Trump, and oh, morale has never been higher, you know, in the department, and we have total free reign, openly disobeying their own like 4-star general secretary that had been appointed to be in charge of them. Like, I don't know where we go from here on this. And I don't see how you can say like, oh, some tinkering around with some sort of reform of ICE or the Border Patrol is going to fix this. It's like, no, like we have to come up with entirely new institutions to deal with this. I understand that there's going to be something to handle like immigration or border checkpoints or whatever, but this is not the system. This is not workable. You can't have these guys saying, oh, we have total control at the airports. We have, you know, hundreds of miles of jurisdiction into, you know, New England and the American Southwest to be able to check anybody's papers, you know, because they might potentially be quote unquote illegals. Like, this is just spiraling out of control rapidly and is not getting that much attention. And I don't understand why the abolish ICE stuff is not gaining more traction and getting into more mainstream circles. Rachel, I know you wanted to talk about this a bit as well.
I just think it's concerning. As people on the left have pointed out, we have this well-armed authoritarian branch of Homeland Security. And a lot of people, without exaggeration, I would say, are calling them basically brown shirts. It's very concerning just to see what they're doing to people that are innocent. They're not violent criminals. They're just trying to make a better life for themselves. And to see them being detained, fiscal year 2017 was the deadliest year for immigrants in detention. 12 immigrants died from October 2016 to September 2017. That's very concerning. And they are being detained in these privately owned facilities. And in Houston, 8 immigrants have died since 2003. In Arizona, 15 immigrants have died since 2003. So it's just very concerning that we have these persistent problems with getting medical care and suicide prevention for these detained immigrants who oftentimes haven't committed any violent acts. And they're being put in solitary confinement as well, which I believe is a human rights violation. So it's just very concerning that we are basically torturing these people for no reason. And we really need to examine what the Department of Homeland Security is doing in our name.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Just and to build off Bill's earlier point about, you know, basically refusing to obey orders at the airports, and also the weird jurisdictional issues that they have within 100 miles of the border, and that's obviously U.S. and Canada, Canada and Mexico. But there's a lot of the country that's within those 100 miles, and I'm just thinking, you know, if there was ever a situation where we had another 9/11 style or size terrorist attack, or even something like anthrax or things like that, the way that essentially, I feel like the airport system or situation would become just the norm everywhere. And, you know, people joke like, oh, this is fascist America. This is Trump's a fascist. I think we would really see what that would look like if there was another large style terrorist attack and then everyone's getting their papers checked, you know, 100 miles from the border or not, probably. So, yeah, it does seem like there's just a pretty terrible situation. And, yeah, as you mentioned, all these ICE detention centers, like I've seen pictures of them where people are just lying on not even cots, really just like barely mattresses on the ground. And it does seem like this is not exactly all that far off from sort of just large scale detention camps. And
they keep having these federal lawsuits, too, where they're like, we have a teenage girl in custody and she's pregnant and she wants to get an abortion. And we're saying no because of some ideological stuff about abortion. Like there's just horrible, like nightmarish deprival of autonomy. And they're not deporting these people out. They're not moving them out. Not to say like, oh, that's the solution either. We got to get higher turnover rate or whatever, because as we've talked about on previous episodes of this show, the quote unquote trials that they get for being an undocumented person fighting deportation, like in many cases, they do not get an attorney. They don't go through the normal due process. Children have to represent themselves. So you had like 4 and 5 year olds with like basically a guardian representative, but not an actual lawyer, like trying to argue their case for judges to be like, yes, I need asylum in this country. I can't go home. And they're like 5 year olds who speak Spanish and they're from Honduras. Like, what is the system that we've created here? It's been here for a long time, but man, it's out of control. All right, we're going to go to a break, and then we're going to be talking in the next segment about issues of surveillance and giving more tools to the Border Patrol, which apparently Congress just decided to do. So we'll be right back in just a second from ArsenalForDemocracy.com and WVUD. Stick around. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate, and on the line with me is Rachel. So far this hour, we've been talking about immigration, the need to abolish ICE, some of the recent sort of authoritarian developments over the past year under the Trump administration. Switching gears a little bit, but still remaining on some of the same topics, we're going to be talking about surveillance, like the FISA reauthorization discussions, and we're going to be talking about the Markey Tsongas bill that actually got signed into law, one of the rare things that actually got signed into law. So for all you people who for some inexplicable reason are complaining that Trump's not doing enough governing and signing enough things into law, they got a bad law passed and it got signed and it was sponsored by the Democrats. So congratulations, team, the Interdict Act. By the way, any of the links that we've been talking about this week are pretty much all going to be in a list available at ArsenalForDemocracy.com. Generally, every week, we try to upload a list with all our links if we were talking about a whole bunch of different news articles and stuff. I guess before we talk FISA reauthorization, just to continue rolling on the discussion about the border stuff that we were talking about at the end of the last segment, again, Markey Tsongas, the International Narcotics Trafficking Emergency Response by Detecting Incoming Contraband with Technology Act, also known as the Interdict Act. Great job on the acronym, everyone. Give yourselves a round of applause. But you did just give more technology to the Border Patrol, supposedly to stop all this heroin coming into the country.
Fentanyl.
Got to give them more stuff. I mean, it would be fine if they gave them more dogs, although I personally don't support dogs being in the Border Patrol just because no dog should have to be in the 5-0. But I just don't understand how Democrats were like, and this was introduced back in March of 2017. I vaguely remember them introducing it, but I didn't think much of it. And I definitely didn't think that a Democratic sponsored bill in both chambers was going to be the thing that somehow made it through. And they were like, oh yeah, man, we're going to pass the Interdict Act and give Border Patrol more stuff, more toys, more tools, more weapons. They got to get more power. After all that, that's what they took away. They were like, After witnessing the first several months of 2017, we've decided to introduce legislation to give more stuff to the Border Patrol and give them more power so they can solve our nation's problems. And then what do? They continue to stand by this bill and actually get it signed into law somehow. I don't understand. And then there wasn't even that much coverage. I feel like I'm in crazy town. What's going on anyway? This is just like the whole thing here is just people like talking about nonsense all the time, and then the random stuff that does get through doesn't get any attention and is bad. How did the Democrats land on this? I'm like confused. I feel like the Democrats somehow managed to like evade my already low expectations for what they were going to do in response to Trump in the first year.
They're pretty good at that, actually, just like constantly like going below expectations. And one of the things they're really skilled at.
It's like a full-time drilling operation for expanding the basement below your already terrible expectations for how they're going to handle this. But this is the thing, right? This one and what we're about to talk about with the Pfizer reauthorization, it's like the Democrats are going on and on about how the Trump administration is this tyrannical, dictatorial break from American history, which is false, and then saying like this is extremely concerning for American democracy. And then they respond by being like, why don't we give more drug sniffing tools to like the rogue agency of the government that only answers personally to Donald Trump and wants thousands more agents hired?
Yeah. And also falling in love with the deep state. CIA is woke. So everything like that. And polling bears out on that for Democrats, which is pretty disturbing.
Let's talk a little bit about, that was like a brief kind of tangent that I did want to mention about the Interdict Act, but I didn't have a whole lot else to say about that beyond the Border Patrol stuff we already talked about in the last segment. Let's talk about the Pfizer reauthorization stuff. Our friend of the show and past many time guest, Jonathan Cohn, has up on his medium.com/@JonathanCohn. You can go to his blog there where he like does write-ups on various bills and votes in Congress. He wrote a thing, why are these Democrats supporting Trump's unconstitutional spying on American citizens? He opens by talking about how Adam Schiff, who I guess is speculated to be one of the leading potential people for running for governor of California. I don't know if he's officially in for that or not. I don't know what the timeline on that is, but Representative Adam Schiff is one of these hashtag resistance Democrats on Twitter, constantly posting about stuff. Has said that Donald Trump is, quote, the worst president in modern history and is a threat to American democracy. And yet he voted to reauthorize this giant warrantless surveillance thing. The Brennan Center referred to it as codifying warrantless searches of Americans. There was this attempt by various sort of libertarian Republicans, which there aren't that many of, and civil liberties Democrats, which again, there aren't that many of, to try to like do a major reform of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Courts. That just basically didn't happen. They were unsuccessful in those attempts.
The USA Rights Act failed 183 to 233.
And, it's passed through the House now. I don't know if it's still got to go on to the Senate, and maybe there's going to be like a Rand Paul filibuster, although I really just don't actually see that happening. I don't know what the details on that are, the latest. But I will say that just this is sort of an ongoing pattern where like both parties are like, yeah, don't spy on Americans, except definitely spy on Americans. Let's have more warrantless searches. And every time there's some sort of a crime or allegation of wrongdoing or misconduct, they just pass like a retroactive like, oh no, that thing's actually okay, we were fine with that, it was against the law, but now we're fine with it, and the warrantless component of this is basically like, if you're in a formal investigation, you do have to seek a warrant, but if you're just in the assessment phase where you're trying to decide if there should be an investigation, then you don't need a warrant to do searches on Americans. It continues to boggle the mind how the response to this like supposedly unparalleled threat to democracy, this like unacceptable presidency or whatever, oh, we got to give them more surveillance tools, because somehow they've all managed in their minds to divorce the intelligence agencies and stuff from the Trump administration. and going on and on about the good work of the brave men and women of the NSA, FBI, and CIA.
Who were crying when they had to torture people just because it was that hard for them.
Thanks, Nick Kristof. So that's sort of where we are on that. Rachel, what was your reaction to this developments on the Pfizer reauthorization?
I just think it's ridiculous that we are railing against the executive powers and the expansion of those powers, yet the legislative branch is readily ceding their power to the executive branch. It just goes to show that this hashtag resistance is all talk, no action, and it's very, very frustrating. And I hope to see a lot of these 56 Democrats or 55 Democrats primaried soon.
You know,
so hopefully we'll be hearing more about that.
Even some of these, setting aside the bad congressional Dems, because there were some congressional Dems who were on the right side of this, but setting aside the bad ones, like, where's the sort of, I mean, maybe I'm just not privy to these circles, but where's the, like, base outrage from just ordinary Democratic, like, normie resistance people? Like, I feel like maybe I'm wrong because we just, like, followed a lot of the blogosphere stuff back in the day, but, like, when it was George W. Bush or whatever, you'd have Democrats in Congress voting for this stuff, and we were mad about it, but there were a lot of people being, like, out there in sort of the ether or whatever, being like, I don't think the Democrats should be doing this. This is a mistake. Why are we giving more power to George W. Bush? That sort of things. I feel like now they're just, I'm not hearing it really. Like, they're so much more concerned about alleged KGB, which there is no KGB. Stop that. Come on. But, like, alleged KGB, Russian Soviet surveillance operations and computer nets.
Bots.
Yeah,
botnets.
And, like, are they hacking the U.S. Senate or whatever? It's like the CIA hacked the U.S. Senate a few years ago. That just happened. But you guys love them and you want them all to run for Congress. Like, all these candidates keep popping up being like, I'm a CIA career officer and I'm running for the Democrats for Congress. And we're just going to get stuck in a situation where all of American politics electorally is waged contests between Breitbart FBI guys running for Congress and CIA agents running for Congress from the Democrats. Like, that's what American politics is going to be in the way things are heading. Where is this, like, what resistance is, like, they took the word resistance immediately after the Trump election and then just proceeded to not do any of the things that would be associated with actual resistance. If you think this guy's the new Hitler, what are you doing, like, increasing warrantless domestic surveillance?
Yeah, but I think, I mean, maybe they believe that to an extent, but you got to remember also about 20 years ago, Trump was a New York Democrat and he still believed all the same things. So it's sort of, you know, Clintons were at his wedding and all that stuff. But going back to what I was referencing earlier, like, there are actual polls that show the dramatic transformation of Democratic sort of base opinion about, say, the CIA and, you know, all of this. And it's much more favorable, you know, since Trump has come in and he's been able to posture, oh, the deep state is out to get me. And there is sort of that cultural clash between the sort of like Trump land FBI guys, especially in the New York office, that were trying to get Hillary and really were not huge fans of her. It was basically Breitbart in there. I think there were reports of that. And then sort of like the cosmopolitan, more CIA types who like speak other languages and like, you know, go all around the world. And, you know, they're much more attached to sort of like norms and things like that. So they're against Trump and now they're all Democrats. And so Democrats are totally on board with that, you know, sort of throwing away all the history of everything bad the CIA has ever done, which is quite extensive, and just sort of think, oh, yeah, the CIA guys, they're cool, they're woke, and so it doesn't really matter. They can run for Congress, that's fine. Maybe we'll vote for Evan McMullen, who is, you know, convincing Al-Qaeda to work with us in Syria. I think he tweeted that out at one point. So, but yeah, as you mentioned, Bill, in the Bush administration, going back to the sort of blogosphere days, that was pretty much the issue. Remember the 2006, the story broke about FISA and warrantless wiretapping, things like that. And that pretty much dominated the conversation. And that was sort of everything was framed around that. And how are we going to push for FISA reform? And then I think Nancy Pelosi ended up killing that. And so there was all sorts of things like that. But now it's just come to accept it. Everyone's going to spy on you. We don't really care. But if the Russians spy, we need to crack down on them and do everything. And that's so, I mean, it just seems like people don't really care anymore. and they can just rationalize it away and think it's fine because, oh, they're trying to protect us. That's the CIA's job, apparently. But just going back to the CIA's history, that's not exactly what their job has been. So
I kept thinking, like, after Trump got elected, I don't know why, but, like, I kept trying to have some sort of hope that, like, maybe people were going to be galvanized by this and, like, actually, like, draw a line in the sand and, like, start rethinking a lot of this stuff. And I feel like it just didn't happen. Like, now we've had this, like, year and almost a quarter since his election, and the resistance is a joke. And it
looks
just
like
didn't materialize.
And,
yeah. I don't know what happens now. Like, it's very hard to, like, I mean, you know, if you've listened to the show for a while or you know me for a while, like, obviously we do talk a lot about the Democrats and focus on the Democrats and stuff like that, but, like, we're very critical of the Democrats and we always have been. You know, Nate and I grew up together and always spent years complaining about the Democrats and talking about how they needed to be better and stuff like that. And we didn't have, like, high expectations going into this, but, you know, it's very challenging when you feel like the major opposition party is not really doing anything, and, you know, they're actively undermining your efforts on the outside to take more radical positions or whatever. And I guess that, and it's like, okay, fine, I guess that's what we expected, but, like, I don't know. And I guess it's I'm actually less concerned even about the sort of elite level, like, elected Democrats or whatever. Like, they've been bad for a while, so I didn't expect that much from them. But the sort of, as Nate was talking about, you know, the public perception stuff of, like, taking cues from this and, like, instead of questioning why there were so many, you know, under the Bush years, we had a lot of, like, we need more and better Democrats. Why are all these Democrats voting with Bush a lot of the time? Now it's like, it's such a cognitive dissonance thing where they're not even trying to, like, rectify or reconcile those two things in their head at the same time of, like, they're like, as long as they post the right things periodically on Twitter being like, Trump's bad, what a bad Trump, then, like, they don't have to actually do anything, or they can literally do the exact opposite of what they should be doing and people will, like, justify it in
their
heads.
They're not posting about this story.
Yeah.
It's Jonathan who's posting about this story. So, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I honestly don't know what happens from here. Like, I don't, like, it's very disconcerting to, like, not really see. And I wasn't certainly someone who, like, had an accelerationist perspective or anything on this. Like, I didn't expect, like, this to be the line in the sand that everyone was going to, like, rise up and finally see the light. Like, I didn't have that perspective, but I definitely thought that more people were going to maybe at least say the right things, and they often do not. Again, as a reminder, like last week, if you want to tweet at AFD Radio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com, like, those are great ways that you can suggest topics that you want to hear on the show. Because we basically did do a year and a quarter of episodes that had a ton of big ideas for, like, pretty sweeping changes and reforms or, like, major policy ideas that we wanted to talk about. And those were really cool, but eventually we ran out of the things on our list. So if there are things that you want to hear more about or you have ideas, we can't guarantee that they're going to make it on the show, but we're certainly willing to entertain those. So email us those, tweet us those. You can also email through a form at arsenalfordemocracy.com, the website for the radio show. And we, as I said at the beginning, we all the links to, like, news articles and stuff that we talked about today, that will be available at a link for the episode this week, episode 210. So, Nate, thank you so much for being here this week in studio.
Thanks, Bill.
And Rachel, thank you so much for being on the line.
Thanks, Bill. Always a pleasure.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on arsenalfordemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.